Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Welcome, one and all, to the podcast of The Richard Bacon Show, The Daily Bacon. Today, without bacon, I'm Dan Walker. I was sitting in for Richard between 2 and 4 on 5 Live. But despite all that, we still have three tasty chunks for you. You'll be hearing from Martin Williams, a former British diplomat who was working in Tehran in 1979 at the time of the Iranian hostage crisis. You may have seen the film Argo, Ben Affleck's masterpiece, inverted commas, which won the Best Picture at last year's Oscars in 2013. Well, Martin Williams tells a slightly different story of British involvement in rescuing five of those six American diplomats who eventually got out of Tehran by pretending to be an American film crew. He's coming up. So too Holly Granger, the British actress who is playing one of history's great characters, Bonnie Parker, one half of Bonnie and Clyde. And also, as we always do on a Thursday, you'll also be able to hear Chart the Week. But we shall start the Daily Bacon with Martin Williams. Martin, thank you very much for coming on 5 Live.
Thanks very much indeed. Nice to be on the programme.
Oh, it's great to have you on. It's a fascinating story as well. So in 1979, you were working in the British Embassy in Tehran. Let's sort of build up the story before we get to the finer details. I mean, how uncomfortable a time was that to be a British diplomat in that country?
When we arrived in the country in November 1977, there was an indication that, you know, there could be some little political disturbances, but there was no indication of any major upheaval in prospect. And we looked forward to a very pleasant stay there for probably something like 4 years. But of course, then things became more and more disrupted, and it became a more and more hot place for a British diplomat to be.
So at that time, when the American embassy was entered by the Iranian students, in the sort of preceding days and the weeks before that, had there been a feeling that something like that might happen?
There'd been a lot of things which led up to that. As 1978 went through, the situation became more and more disrupted and more uncertain, with demonstrations in the streets and people being shot and killed when demonstrating for liberalisation, essentially, or for a change, at any rate, for the Shah to leave. Our own embassy was attacked and set on fire. In fact, the British Embassy, that was, while we were inside it on the 5th of November 1978.
And was that students as well?
It was part of the demonstrations against the Shah and the people who were perceived to be supporting the Shah or in favour of the Shah. And we had that reputation at that stage. And to say students, I imagine most of them were students, but, you know, they were political activists of one sort or another, young people. And they came and, as I say, attacked the embassy and set it on fire. There were all lots of other places being attacked around that period of time. But it certainly wasn't a very pleasant way of spending an afternoon to have the embassy attacked in that way. And then a fire started inside it while we were still there.
So tell us about the events of the night in 1979 then. When did you first hear of the storming of the American embassy by the, well, we call them students, but the activists?
Yeah. The embassy had been the centre of pretty large-scale political demonstrations for several days before that. And the problem had really started about a couple of weeks previously when the Shah, by then he'd left the country, of course, he's no longer in control at all, he was admitted for medical treatment into the United States, and a lot of people felt that this would cause more trouble on the ground in Tehran. So we weren't altogether surprised when these huge demonstrations were taking place right outside the U.S. embassy. But we had no idea exactly what was going to happen. And so when on the 4th of November the demonstrators suddenly broke through the railings, overcame the resistance of the armed U.S. Marine Guards. They didn't use their weapons, of course, because it would have been absolutely disastrous if they had done. But anyway, they overcame the resistance and they took hostage pretty well everyone who was inside. But again, as I say, this wasn't the first time that we'd had something like that. The U.S. Embassy itself had been occupied earlier in that year, on the 14th of February, by a similar sort of group of demonstrators, but they were persuaded to leave after about 4 hours. And so when the incursion, the invasion, happened on the 4th of November, nobody knew whether that was going to last for 4 hours or 4 weeks or days or months or whatever.
And over the course of our interview, I'm really interested to see exactly how the story developed and interweaved with what we see in Ben Affleck's film Argo. Yeah. But before we go to the news and sport on Five Live, when did you hear that some American diplomats had escaped?
We didn't hear until the following day, the 5th of November, when a telephone message got through to us to say that there were some American diplomats, much to our surprise, who were sheltering in part of the city.
And where did that come from, Martin? Where did that information come from that they'd escaped?
They were in touch with a senior American diplomat who at the time at the embassy had been attacked, was actually in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tehran. And, of course, once the embassy was attacked and occupied, he stayed in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But he was able, by some means, to keep in touch with other people. And somehow or other, the message got through to him, and he contacted us to say, there are some people who need to be picked up. Can we help?
And these, just for people who are picking up on this story, these are the five. These five eventually make up five of the six who we see in Ben Affleck's Argo film.
That's correct. We didn't know how many we were going to be picking up, but we were just told to see if we could find them and to look after them. And so a colleague of mine, Gordon Peary, and I went out in a couple of vehicles to try to find them, given the instructions which we'd received from this, as I say, this senior diplomat who was in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We had difficulty in locating them, but eventually we managed to do so. We thought that there were only going to be about three or four, but it turned out that there were only going to be five of them, so we had to pick up someone else from somewhere else and then decide what to do with them. Meantime, I'd discovered by telephoning the embassy that our own embassy had also been occupied, because the telephone operator wasn't there. Someone answered in Farsi saying that the embassy had been occupied. And so we'd got these American diplomats, and the last thing we wanted to do was to take them back to our own embassy, where they'd be just put straight into the fire again. And so we took them back to our own house, in fact.
How dangerous was it when you went out into Iran to find these five, which others were looking for at the same time, I would imagine?
Well, I'm not sure who else would have been looking for them. If they'd been found by people who were sympathetic to the groups who were inside the US embassy, then undoubtedly they'd have been turned in. But I don't think there were any sort of troops or groups which had been sent out to try to find them, because I don't think at that stage anybody knew that there were any people missing.
So were they, when you found them, were they worried? Were they concerned?
Oh, very much so. They were terrified, in fact, I'd say. They were very alarmed indeed, and they were delighted to meet someone who they regarded as a friend and a rescuer, I think.
I've got an ignorant question alert, Martin. Was there some sort of code word yet to use so that they knew you were a man they could trust? How did you approach them, and how did you sort of get their trust?
Well, they were looking out for us. They knew that there was somebody from the British Embassy coming to rescue them. As I say, we had a little difficulty actually locating them, but they were looking out for us, and so eventually we did make contact. And I spoke to them as a British diplomat, and they obviously trusted the way I spoke.
And what sort of vehicle were you in?
I was using my own car, an Austin Maxi, coloured a bright shade of desert sand, as it was called, which was more or less orange.
Blending in, then, were you?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you then pick up these five diplomats, and what happens then?
Well, because our own embassy at that time was also occupied by some groups from outside, we didn't know who they were, I took them back to my own house. We were at that time living in an embassy house inside a residential compound in the northern part of the city. And so I let my wife know that we were going to have some visitors for supper, rather to her surprise.
Surprising five visitors, though, aren't they? Yeah.
And we didn't talk about who they were. But when we got safely to to our house, they were made welcome. We gave them something to drink. We gave them some food. We made up beds for them in the adjacent house, and I warned them to keep out of sight because the embassy compound was not exactly, we couldn't control totally all the access. It was a slightly open place. Anyway, we then had to try to work out what to do about the fact that our own embassy was being attacked and was being occupied, because that's not a very comfortable situation to find yourself in.
Now, I know you've seen the film Argo. Many of our listeners will have seen it as well. Now, in that film, the escaped diplomats are turned away from the British embassy. Now, from what you're telling us, that doesn't appear to be true to life.
Absolutely. And what happened was that immediately after they'd walked out from the US embassy and managed to escape the hostage takers, they walked through the streets to the British embassy in the hope that they could get some sort of shelter there. But they found that that was also surrounded by demonstrators. And so they gave up that and sought some shelter, in fact, in one of the apartments which they had. But then the film says that the Argo film by Ben Affleck says that when they went to the Brits, they were turned away. And this is absolutely the opposite of the case, because as soon as we heard that they were there, we went looking for them. We took them in, we gave them food and shelter. And in fact, we would have continued to look after them as long as was necessary, except that our own embassy was also under attack and was being invaded and occupied. And consequently, it wouldn't have done them any good if we'd been found sheltering them the next time that the invaders came into our premises.
Martin, did you know that was the case in terms of how they depicted that in the story when you watched the film, or were you rather peeved when you saw it for the first time?
I'd heard in advance some friends in America had told us that there was a throwaway remark, a sort of a in passing, that the Brits had turned them away, and so I was expecting it. But all the same, it was not exactly welcome, I can tell you, because it was literally the opposite of the truth.
But I'm sure you understand that the filmmakers have a story they need to develop, and I don't think they ever claimed it exactly true to life. It was based on a true story, but does
they
that
do claim it's a true story?
But does that annoy you that history has been retold in a way that you obviously don't remember it?
Well, we know what actually happened, and I think that it's a pity if the impression is given amongst all the audience who see it in the United States that the Brits couldn't be relied upon to give assistance when the Americans needed it, when exactly the opposite is the case.
Why wasn't it talked about then?
How do you mean, why wasn't what talked about?
Why wasn't it brought up at the time? Why wasn't it?
Well, at the time that it happened in 1979, we were very anxious to keep our own involvement fairly quiet, because if we'd talked about the British embassy having been involved in the whole process, then we'd have endangered our own embassy staff. And that wasn't a good idea at all. If we wanted to function at all as an embassy, despite all the difficulties, then we got to be able to continue to maintain at least an element of security. And so that would have been endangered if we'd talked about our help to the Americans. So we didn't talk about it, deliberately kept it quiet.
So pick up the story for a second. So you've got these Americans staying at your residence. Your wife has given them supper, but you're not allowed to tell your wife exactly who they are and what they're doing and why they're there.
As soon as they'd arrived, of course, she knew who they were.
Yes.
But I hadn't told them over the telephone. I told her over the telephone.
And then what happens then? Because according to this programme, you were involved in moving these American diplomats several times before were actually moved out of Iran.
Yeah, that's right. Because of the trouble which we'd had in our own embassy, we managed, incidentally, to get the invaders to leave our embassy after about 5 or 6 hours. And so the staff were able to return to normal. But because of that fact, we decided that, our own attempts to provide them shelter and security weren't very effective as long as they were in premises which were liable to be attacked at any time. And so we moved them the following day, Gordon and I, to another house which was more anonymous and therefore provided a greater degree of security.
Was that in the Austin Maxi again, was it?
Yep, absolutely.
You haven't still got the car, by the way.
No, this was 35 years ago.
I know, but you never know.
You never know. Sentimental reasons, yes.
It's worth asking.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you move them again, and eventually they end up at the Canadian embassy, residency, as they did.
A few days later, after they'd been in touch with someone with a contact of their own in the Canadian embassy, we drove them from where we'd dropped them and took them to this Canadian embassy residence. It wasn't actually with the ambassador, although the ambassador obviously knew what was happening. And we left them there because the Canadians, unlike the British and the Americans, were not particularly targets or under suspicion. So that was a safer place for them to be. And that's where they stayed until this extraordinary scheme was devised by the CIA to get them out of the country, in fact, a couple of months later.
At any stage, Martin, did you feel in danger? You said that they were worried and concerned and about what they'd seen and what might happen to them. But did you feel that concern at any stage?
Oh, yes, we knew we were in danger. And our embassy had been attacked and set on fire while we were in it. I'd encountered numerous roadblocks where people, you know, were pointing guns at us. Friends, or at least we knew of other diplomats in who was stopped at a roadblock and was shot and killed. And the attacks took place on, you know, we were definitely being singled out for particular attention. We knew it was a dangerous situation, but, you know, we had to do this.
We're in conversation with Martin Williams, who is telling us about his role as a British diplomat working in Tehran in 1979, if you're just joining us, during the Iranian hostage crisis. You may have seen the film Argo, and Martin was telling us about the British role in that. Of Martin had to go into Tehran to find five of the six American diplomats who eventually became the six central characters in Ben Affleck's film. He took them back to his own residence and ferried them around Iran for a while before eventually dropping them off at the residence, not of the Canadian ambassador, but where Canadian House. And Martin, that's where we left the story. So let's pick it up from that point. Were you aware of the plan by the CIA agent Tony Mendez to disguise these diplomats as filmmakers to get them out of the country?
Well, we weren't involved at all with the CIA end of the story, because once we delivered them to the Canadians, given the fact that we were being under attack, the best thing was for us to have as little to do as possible with them for the remaining time. Of course, if the Canadians wanted help, then we would have been only too happy to give it. But we didn't go looking for it. And so I didn't know anything about the rescue idea, this bizarre theory that they would be scouting locations for a science fiction film to be shot in Iran by a bunch of Canadians on behalf of Hollywood. It's a bizarre story, but it did what was required, and so that was very successful. Just if I may mention a couple of things in relation to that.
Of course you can, yeah.
The film which is going to be shown about this on the television tonight is going to be on Yesterday Channel at 10 o'clock. It's the first in a series of programmes about CIA declassified. And this tells the extraordinary story of how they actually got out of Iran. The film, which was made by Ben Affleck, shows all kinds of things happening as part of that process, which didn't actually occur. This film on the television this evening, in fact, is a series of interviews with the escaping diplomats, and they tell the story as it actually occurred. And I think it's, you know, it's very nail-biting and exciting and tense if you get it, even without the sort of extra souping up being given by the Hollywood treatment.
So one of those stories that doesn't require the Hollywood treatment, if you like.
I think so, yes. The second thing I wanted to mention, if I could, is that I'm giving a talk on this subject tomorrow evening in Tunbridge Wells, where better, at 7:30 at St John's Church. And so if any of your listeners want to hear the more details about this and the background to it, you know, I think there are still some tickets available. It's all for a local charity.
There you go. That's a very good plug.
St John's Church in Tunbridge Wells tomorrow evening at 7:30.
I once had a very good scone in Tunbridge Wells, which is of no significance whatsoever. But
I'm sure you can get excellent scones there and other things as well.
Right, that's tomorrow night. And the programme is on UK TV tonight at 10 as
yes,
part of this series.
Yesterday Channel.
CIA Declassified. It's called The Real Argo.
That's it.
In terms of, as this story developed then, you said that it was a sort of crackpot plan from your perspective. You didn't use those words,
yes,
crackpot, but it sounded a bit strange and crazy. Do you think that the British government would have ever sanctioned a plan like that?
I don't see why not. I mean, the fact is that if you're in that sort of situation, you've got to come up with something original and effective. And, you know, one has to admit that in the circumstances of Iran in those days, anything which looked logical and straightforward might well have been regarded with a great deal of suspicion. By that stage, the large numbers of British people who'd previously been living in Iran had practically all left. And so we couldn't have pretended that they were just people who'd been living in the country for some time. They were obviously short-term visitors. And most of these people had only been in the US embassy for a matter of weeks when they were taken hostage. Well, when the embassy was invaded. And so, you know, you'd have to come up with something which was going to do, which was going to be effective.
Martin, can I ask you? I mean, I know that you've sort of complained a little bit about Argo and the fact that it did play with the truth of the story. Do you think generally that films like that are good for a modern audience to understand, even if it's not 100% of the truth in your eyes, that understanding exactly what happened in fascinating historical circumstances like that?
Yes, if you want to have a general picture of the sort of thing which was going on, then I can't fault it. And it's an exciting film. There were certainly exciting times. The general setting which it shows is pretty realistic. There's no doubt about that. But if they're going to call it a true story, the fact is that a film is a very powerful means of conveying a story. And if most of the audience who see it get the impression that when the Americans needed help, the Brits turned them away, then I regret that.
Also on the show, we spoke to Holly Granger, a young British actress who you may have seen before in programmes like The Borgias. This time round, she has a new TV miniseries out where she plays Bonnie Parker, one half of Bonnie and Clyde. We spoke to her about mastering the American accent, about getting the better of a rather complicated character, and also portraying one of America's most notorious gangsters. Holiday Granger, who is a young British actress, who I've never met anybody called Holiday before. Have you ever met another Holiday?
No, I haven't. I did meet a director whose wife's cousin or wife's sister was called Holiday, but I've never met her personally.
And with two L's as well.
Yes, indeed.
Do you shorten it to Holly?
Yeah, most of my friends call me
Holly. Okay, we'll call you Holly Granger then.
Hol,
is that all right?
Holls, call what? Holls. Whatever you want.
The Hol Dog?
G, just call me G.
Okay, all right. Holly is one half of America's most notorious crime couple. Bonnie Parker you play in a brand new Bonnie and Clyde. The series starts tonight at 9 on the newly launched Lifetime channel. Now, were you ever a student of history? Did you enjoy the historical part of sort of getting into the character and finding out exactly what she and they did together?
I did, because I grew up hearing about Bonnie and Clyde as, I mean, most of us do, but it was only when I started really researching them all that I started to learn more about them, because I had Bonnie and Clyde in my head and synonymous almost with, like, Romeo and Juliet or Thelma and Louise as these, like, mythical figures almost. And so it wasn't until I started, you know, looking into biographies and stuff that I realised quite how exciting and short-lived their life was.
I shall fill people in if they don't know, because like you, I think most people have this idea of who they might have been and that they did stuff and shot people and were not particularly well liked. Well, in the American Depression, Bonnie and Clyde spent 2 years duping police and avoiding capture for a series of violent robberies. They were eventually shot dead in 1934 after they killed at least 13 people. Their love affair was first brought to the big screen by Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway in 1967. This new miniseries with Holly in it tells the story a little differently, because in this version, the crime spree is Bonnie Parker's idea.
I see the two of us waking up one day with all this behind us, with everything we ever dreamed of. Now, maybe the road we're taking to get to Dreamland isn't the greatest, but it's the road that called us. And if you're demanding we stop this thing we're doing, then I don't know. Maybe I'm going to have to find some other way to get where I'm supposed to be.
Let's start with the accent. Love the accent.
That was so weird hearing that.
Weird because why? Because it was hard work to capture it or what?
Oh, just this. I mean, I feel so departed from that already, because that was like last year that it's strange hearing it. But I had to work on it. I watched lots of Sissy Spacek films, actually, because she was from Texas, and she does that kind of, she has this lovely subtle gravelly voice. Or I listen to loads of people. There's this website called the International Dialect Archive where you can really super specific about where and when you're listening from. You even know the educational background of who you're listening to,
and you just go through that and you listen to it again and again.
And listen to the, like, get as specific to Bonnie as possible and listen and repeat.
I remember talking to John Culshaw once, and he was saying when he was doing his, I know it's not an impression, but when he's doing his impressions, he has like trigger words that if he feels he's losing it at all, he goes back to those and they fire him off on the right line again. Did you have that sort of thing with the accent?
Yeah, I in fact, I had a poem that I can't remember who it was by, just to help me with my R's. But I do, every time I do an accent and then I have to revisit the accent later, years down the line for something else, there always seems to be a line from last time I did it that kind of triggers it back.
And how difficult, the accent obviously you nailed, but how difficult was the character to get your head round? Because historically, people are unsure about what sort of person she really was, Bonnie Parker.
Yeah, I mean, I love the scripts because she was such a strong, sassy, like, ambitious, like, driving force to the story. But then it wasn't until I started doing a bit of research and reading her poetry and her diaries and her her love letters that you can still access amazingly, that I kind of heard this lost little vulnerable voice, like quite a young little girl. And so it was interesting trying to add a bit of that vulnerability into her kind of sassiness.
Which is a bit different to the way that famously Faye Dunaway played Bonnie, what was it, in the 60s. Because, I mean, I was reading this afternoon, she was described as playing with a sort of a worldly sexuality, if that makes sense to you. Far more brazen,
really,
if you like.
Yeah. Cool and collected about the way Faye Dunaway played it, whereas the Bonnie in our scripts is almost a bit more like psychotic, actually, in bits.
Did you have somebody in mind when you...
No, maybe just lots of different people for different bits. But, I mean, it's an amazing part to be able to play, having that... You know, Bonnie has panic attacks and she gets to shoot guns and she gets to be kind of putting on this character of the super sexy gangster. And so it's just kind of a dream for an actor to just go in and play all of these things in one project.
Do you think she was as violent as we sort of feel that she may have been?
No. No. I mean, I suppose. Well, my favourite biography that I read was written by her mum, so her Emma Parker's not going to, you know, paint her daughter in this kind of villainous way, I suppose. But I guess everything that I've read about her really did sort of put her in Clyde's shadow, I guess. But it's just far more interesting to have a TV show that's being driven by the girl and driven by the woman, and having the woman as the kind of strong driving force of it. And so I prefer to stay true to the script than what I think the real Bonnie might have been.
What about the time on the run? Because there was these 2 years where, you know, over the course of those 2 years they killed 13 people, or it's believed they killed 13 people, and it came to a very gruesome end, didn't it? Because the pair of them were shot over 50 times in a car after being someone had dobbed them in to protect his son. Is that the case? And then six police officers found them in the car and shot them over 50 times, and they never fired a gun, did they, in that time?
Exactly. They were executed, basically, on the road. I think Clyde was shot like 49 times and Bonnie 57 or something ridiculous like that.
Just to make sure.
Yeah, and I did read somewhere that they both had like half-eaten burgers in their laps when they died as well. And Bonnie had a packet of cigarettes in her laps, like really halfway through.
That's not a nice wedding.
Yeah, no, exactly.
From what you've sort of investigated, you've mentioned sort of reading her love letters and really trying to get a handle on who she was and what she did. And her relationship with her mother was quite an interesting part of her character.
Really strong and really interesting, actually. There's these reading some of her letters, and she got married really super young, when she was like 15 or 16, to first boyfriend before Clyde, not the first proper love. And she was so needy for her mum, she'd cry for her mum so much that even though she only lived down the road from her mum, she made her husband move in with her mum so that she could be with her so much. And that's sort of why Bonnie and Clyde stuck around Texas so much. I mean, they were inevitably going to be caught up within the end because there were so many police after them. But rather than, you know, flying off to Mexico or something, they stuck around because they wanted to be near their families, because there was that bond that was so strong that just kept bringing them back to Texas.
You've obviously delved rather deep into her character. Do you feel you know why she and they did what they did?
I think certainly know why they do in our miniseries. For Clyde, it was more of a revenge against the establishment, because he'd experienced life in prison farms, and he'd been sexually abused, and that was really when he, I think someone said that he went in a young boy and came out like a snake through his experiences in prison. And for Bonnie, it was just, she was quite an intelligent, creative girl, and there was no outlet for that in Dallas at the time. She could be a secretary or a waitress, and so this, and she yearned to be an actor or a writer, and I think this was her way of being recognised. She never made it as an actress, and but she could make it as a
So you think she may have been happy to had stardom, but in a slightly different way?
Yeah, I mean, because back then, instead of having adverts before at the movie theatres, they had newsreel footage, yeah. which would sort of be a soap opera story.
So she was on the big screen. Yeah.
She was on the big screen as like the as almost like the original reality TV star on this kind of painting a soap opera picture of her life on the run.
And we mentioned that Faye Dunaway famously played Bonnie Parker in the 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, don't you, that you're going to be compared to somebody like that and your depiction of the character. Does that daunt you? Does that excite you?
No, not really. It doesn't daunt me only because I'm kind of strangely selfish in that I'm doing what I want
to do.
To
be honest about it.
Yeah, like, I'm doing the Bonnie I want to do. And
you don't care what anyone else has done.
Well, you know, I don't really mind that much what anyone else thinks. I hope people like it, but I did what I thought was fun. So, you know, people are always going to love Faye Dunaway, and I loved Faye Dunaway's version as well.
And how's it gone down in America?
Really well, actually. It was watched by nearly 10 million viewers, which is pretty big for over there. And the response has been great. I just came back from LA yesterday, so it's interesting.
And in America, is it the pair of them seen as almost sort of a cool couple because it happened such a long time ago and you almost forget the violence and the 13 deaths, and because they're such a part of American history that they love to see a different depiction of it?
I think so, but I think that even at the time, particularly at the beginning of their life on the run, Bonnie and Clyde were like iconicized by the public because they were representing this young couple on the run that were representing this anti-establishment, almost Robin Hood figures.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't the inaccessible Chicago gangsters. They were just these kids from Dallas. And I think that's particularly the reason that they managed to be on the run for so long, because no one would dob them in to the police, because everyone wanted Bonnie and Clyde to succeed until they committed so many murders, collateral damage, as we'd maybe call it. And that was only really when the public's view was switched.
I have a question for you from Anthony, because you also play Lucretia in the Borgias.
I do.
He wants to know why it was called off and he wants the final series to come back.
Yeah. I know, me too, I'd love to.
There are a lot of people quite miffed about this, aren't
yeah.
they? Because it was two series and it was three?
It was meant seasons, to, it was always meant to be four. Yeah, so I was always looking forward to like becoming Lucrezia. But, you know, I had to be Bonnie Parker instead, so that's fine.
And isn't it true that because there is such a clamour for that fourth series that they're actually going to, aren't they releasing an ebook to tell what the story was, but obviously
yes.
it's too expensive to make?
I do believe that Neil Jordan has written two episodes which he's releasing as an ebook, I think with the DVD of the third season, so that you can find out what would have happened.
Well, because this is, when you look at your career, Holly, it seems to be that you disappear into a far-flung country for a long time to really get into these roles. And then you only back, you say you turned up from LA yesterday, you only turn back in this country very infrequently. Do you enjoy that lifestyle, if you like?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's partly, it's sort of addicted. I think that's addictive. I think that's kind of why a lot of us get the acting bug, because it's just this experiencing different places, different people, different countries, different parts. Different time periods, actually.
Exactly, yeah. Playing Bonnie Parker. Just a reminder, it's on tonight at 9 o'clock.
It is.
On the Lifetime channel.
It is. First part tonight, 2 hours, and then next part next Thursday at 9.
Okay, well, brilliant to have you on Five Live. Thank you very much. That's Holly, not Holiday.
Holiday, your official name. Don't mind.
Holly Granger, who is playing Bonnie Parker in Bonnie and Clyde. You can see part one tonight on the Lifetime channel at 9 o'clock. Thank you very much for coming
on. Thanks, Dan.
And finally, for today's podcast, we have the regular Thursday slot of Chart the Week, where we look at the top five stories from the week. And joining us to have a good look at the news, we have Nikki Hodgson, a freelance journalist and author, and also regular Andrew Pearce, columnist and consultant editor of the Daily Mail.
It's Thursday, so that can only mean it's time to chart the week.
The voice of Ruby Wax, meaning it is time for Chart the Week, a rundown of the top five most talked about news stories of the last 7 days. I'm Dan Walker. Good afternoon to you all. Coming up in the next half hour, what's the catch of the day? Well, there's 392 days, and it's this dude here.
Praise God for the boat. I pushed myself away from the boat so it wouldn't hit me on the head. But when I got to the shore, I was unable to walk.
Facebook is having a birthday, and it's number 10 this year.
There'll probably be some beer and pizza. We're not very fancy like that. But yeah, it's a big achievement, and we'll definitely mark it.
And if you're a Bolshevik or lefty in a public position, this is the man you should fear.
I want state schools to try out common entrance exams, giving them a chance to check how well they and their pupils are performing.
Joining us today, we have Nicky Hodgson, a freelance journalist and author, and Andrew Pearce, columnist and consultant editor of the Daily Mail. So, everybody, let's chart the week. What an introduction. Let's say hello to Nicky and to Andrew. Good afternoon to you both.
How you doing? Great
to have you on. Thank you very much for coming on. My first ever chart the week. Forgive me, you're regulars, aren't you? You do this quite readily with Richard.
I'm not actually, so it's my first time too.
Oh, this is a big moment for us both.
I do it quite a bit, and I normally squabble with Richard within the first 3 or 4 minutes when he attacks the Daily Mail.
Well, Andrew, feel free to dig away.
Don't worry.
Yeah, Andrew's going to the shovel's here. Pull something back. It seems like this afternoon.
Well, we're going to as Andrew, you've done it before. Nikki, first time. We do the five stories. We're going to start with the story in slot number 5. A Mexican fisherman claims he spent the last 16 months drifting alone in the Pacific Ocean, surviving by eating the raw flesh of seabirds and drinking the blood of turtles.
At number 5,
a castaway was washed up on the Marshall Islands at the weekend, and he says he spent more than a year adrift in the Pacific.
We first found his boat, which was probably a 24-footer, engine broken. Yeah, it was in pretty bad condition.
Castaway or con man? That's the question on the front page of the Mail this morning. It's referring to Jose Salvador Albarengo, a fisherman claiming to have spent over a year adrift at sea.
Praise God for the boat. On the second wave, I threw myself into the sea, and the boat was bobbing up and down in the waves. I pushed myself away from the boat so it wouldn't hit me on the head, but when I got to the shore, I was unable to walk.
Well, that's Jose Salvador Alvarenga, a sharp and shrimp fisherman from Mexico, claims he spent 16 months adrift in the Pacific when his boat's motor broke. This week he turned up in the Marshall Islands, 5,000 miles away from where he started. But his story has been questioned by some, as he seems in surprisingly good shape for someone who spent 392 days drifting across the ocean. Andrew, let's start with you on this one. Do you believe this man?
I struggle, frankly, and it's not just because I'm a cynical old newspaper hack, but when I first saw this on Wires, I thought, come on, 16 months? Look at him. He's broad of girth. He didn't seem particularly exposed to the sun. And the boat is 24-foot fiberglass, and he managed to stay afloat for 5,000 miles in 16 months. And I love this story, but I suspect he's watched The Life of Pi, or read the book, because in The Life of Pi, that young man heroically lives cheek by jowl with a tiger, or is it a lion?
His story is tiger free, though, Andrew.
Yes, it's tiger free, but I'm not sure it's not exaggeration free. I think at some point it would be a bit like the boatman who's been recently returned to jail. I suspect that the truth will out, and it won't be all it seems, because I don't see that a real-life Robinson Crusoe could perhaps have lived on a desert island for 16 months, but living on a 24-foot fiberglass boat, no.
So, Nicky, you don't think we're going to see turtle blood, the new diet for 2014, or the flesh of raw seabirds?
No, perhaps not. Maybe because he isn't quite slim enough to promote it as a weight loss
remedy. I hadn't thought of that. Actually,
That's my thought. Certainly not in Hollywood, anyway. I really sort of agree with Andrew. I would love to believe this, but, you know, I think there's an inclination in all of us because, you know, from something like The Odyssey to The Hunger Games, we love to believe in these survival myths, you know, survival above the odds. So the romantic in us wants to think, oh, my gosh, this person has been capable of such a, you know, superhuman feat. But, yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I don't think this is viable. I mean, in some of the reports that I've read, there's an army officer who's sort of commented that he looks far too fit for a start, but also made some quite sort of observant remarks, such as he would expect him to have problems with his eyesight because the sun had been glinting, and that he'd be covered in sores from salt water and bacteria in the sea on his hands if he'd been actually fishing with his hands.
So you both feel it's only going to be a matter of time before we find a picture of him sipping a pina colada somewhere.
Yeah, because he'd have us believe he survived for a month on his own urine, sorry listeners, and turtle blood, and I think that is highly unlikely. What is he, Frankenstein's monster? Is this Mary Shelley come back to life?
The medics have counted it and said it's nigh on impossible that he managed to do that. So
If you were trying to come up with a story like this, which, let's say, subsequently turns out to be fake, we don't know that for sure yet, do you think he's gone too elaborate on the story then?
Yeah, he could have said half a year. Maybe.
A week.
I think, actually, he might have struggled to survive on that boat for a month, actually. But 16, I suspect there's a mistress. Maybe there's a love child. Now I'm getting into my Hollywood...
claim.
Yeah, exactly, my Hollywood script-writing thing here.
I can see why you normally argue with Richard, Andrew.
Yes, exactly.
Right, well, that is number five, so let's move on to our next story. And a much sadder one, actually. Philip Seymour Hoffman was one of the most acclaimed film and theatrical actors of his generation. On Sunday, the curtain came down on the exceptional Hoffman for the last time.
At number four...
The Oscar-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman has been found dead at his flat in New York. Police say they believe he took a drug overdose. The 46-year-old made his name in the 1990s, starring in films such as The Big Lebowski, Red Dragon and Almost Famous, before winning the Best Actor Oscar for his lead role in the 2005 film Capote.
You went into rehab at a fairly early age.
Yeah, I did.
I got sober when I was 22 years old.
So this was drugs or alcohol or both?
Yes, all that stuff, yeah. Is there anything I can get my hands on? yeah, I liked it all, yeah.
The winner of the Best Actor Oscar and perhaps the most critically celebrated actor of his generation as well. It's hard to think of a single performance that he hasn't nailed and delivered spot on. The 46-year-old Hoffman was found dead in his New York home on Sunday night. Police suspect he died from a heroin overdose, although an initial post-mortem has proved inconclusive. Hoffman, who is survived by his partner and their three children, has detailed his struggles with substance abuse in the past. Certainly one of the saddest stories of the week, Nikki and Andrew. Nikki, let's start with you on this one. How did this story break to you, and what's your reaction been to it?
Yeah, I've been actually quite interested in the commentary that's come after with regards to addiction, potential addiction. Obviously, it's not, like we said, the coroner hasn't conclusively proved that this was an overdose. But Russell Brand wrote quite an interesting comment piece for The Guardian, and he described there being a big problem with how we think about people that are addicts, and that we should think of them as sick rather than bad people.
Hmm.
I slightly take issue with that, because people that have addictions have underlying psychological demons or problems they need to sort of work through, by and large. And so this idea of calling people sick sort of robs them of agency slightly. So when people have addiction, yes, they need help to crack the addiction, but they also need to take it upon themselves at that final stage to commit to, you know, giving up. So, you know, relating it back to Hoffman, we have no idea really that, you know, there's sort of rumours that it was to do with the breakup of a relationship that he relapsed. But, you know, he was sober for 23 years.
Yeah.
So it's not your typical addiction story. You know, this isn't somebody that was struggling on and off, around putting in wonderful performances in film. But I just kind of was, you know, slightly perturbed by Brand's reasoning, and wasn't sure quite how helpful it was, because this story seems to be so unique, actually. You know, we don't have all the facts. We don't know exactly, why he did what he did, or, you know, whether it was related to something that he never had cracked or not. You know, 23 years seems like a long time.
Yeah.
So it would be good to have a few more facts before we kind of start building conclusive theories about what happened.
You're exactly right, Nikki. I think it's hard to say exactly why he did what he did and exactly what the circumstances are. But, Andrew, one thing has been certain is normally when people die in these circumstances, you often get an outpouring of, oh, they're very good, that film was particularly excellent. But it's rare to get so many people across the board saying, listen, he was a key actor, he was incredible at doing those sorts of roles which he was made famous for. And as we said in the introduction there, he rarely got it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, even people like Robert De Niro, who is a man of few words, who gives few interviews, he talked, did he not, about the wonderful actor, and he said this just shouldn't be. And the sad thing is, if it's right that he really was off this stuff for 23 years, it just goes to show, once an addict, always an addict. You're just one fix or one injection from becoming hopelessly addicted again. And there were some very disturbing photographs of the actor in the days before his death. One of them, he was on a plane. He'd clearly virtually passed out. Now, whether that was through alcohol or drugs, and there was anecdotal evidence that he was, on another occasion, he was in a bar off to the loo too often. This was a man who was clearly in trouble. And yet, until a few days before his death, Dan, he was directing theatre at a little local provincial theatre up the road, 95-seater, and his partner or ex-partner was producing the play. This was a man who was giving stuff back for very little money or credit or glory. He really was one of the good guys.
And Nicky, one final point on this. If something good has come out of this, I mean, there'd be a number of television stations and Five Live as well and other radio shows who've had talk shows in the last few days with people talking about their own struggle with addiction and telling their own stories and almost educating others about how, as you say, how difficult it is to get rid of that addiction once you're stuck in it.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. But I'd kind of like to see a bit more analysis about why people do become addicted in the first place. I mean, obviously, some of it's just circumstance, some of it's opportunity. And, you know, like the chemical effect of drugs on the system is such that you don't necessarily have to have, you know, some deep underlying problem that's holding you back to alleviate pain necessarily if it's a kind of recreational thing. But then, for lots of people, it isn't like that. For lots of people, it is that there's a deeper issue that's never been resolved. And so I think it'd be good to sort of open up the dialogue a little bit more and explore what is it that causes people, you know, to take substances that then ruin their lives.
Let's continue with the story we have put at number three. This week, Facebook is celebrating its first decade. It's amazing to recall that before Facebook came along in 2003, it was almost impossible to have an affair with someone you half remembered from school 20 years ago.
At three.
Facebook turns 10 today. The social network now has over 1 billion monthly active users and last year featured on the Fortune 500 list for the first time with a revenue of $5.1 billion.
I think we're probably going to have a little party in here. There'll probably be some beer and pizza. We're not very fancy like that.
It started as a project, but quickly it just caught on, and I think its popularity proved itself almost instantly. So I think he probably had a very good sense that he had a success on his hands. I'm not sure how long it would have taken for him to realize, that soon he would have more than a billion users a month using his product, but I think probably pretty early on he had a sense of, wow, I might have done something good here.
Ten years old, but it's hard to remember a time when Facebook wasn't around. Today, 1.2 billion people worldwide have a Facebook account. That's one in every seven people on the earth. It's undeniable that Facebook changed the way we communicate with one another, but after a decade of success, will the younger generation desert this site for other hipper brands? In other words, is Facebook being unfriended, Andrew Pearce?
It may be by younger people, but don't write off the older generation. I'm not talking about myself here, Dan, before you suggest I am. But because I'm actually not on Facebook as a 50-something guy, but my mother, age 80, is on it two or three times a day.
Why are you not on it, Andrew?
I just haven't felt the need to. I've just gone onto Twitter, and most of my contemporaries, I have to say, aren't on Facebook either. So maybe because it was started, 10 years ago in Harvard, and by which time I was already set in my ways. There's a thing called the telephone, email. I'd say I've joined Twitter. Gosh, I'm getting very radical.
What is this of which you speak?
Yeah, I don't feel I need to go on Facebook. And I do sometimes think when I see Facebook how much young people put of their lives on Facebook. It's extraordinary. There is no intimacy left. There's very little privacy left. And I can remember years and years ago as a young reporter on local papers having to do what we called the fatal door knock when there'd been a terrible accident or somebody had been killed or hurt. We wanted to try and get a photograph of the family. You don't have to do that now. Everything, Dan, is on Facebook. And I wonder sometimes if there are enough boundaries between what it looks like great fun at the time, but then maybe in a few months' time, politicians, particularly ambitious politicians, may regret in 5 years' time what they posted on Facebook two or three years ago.
Nicky, you a Facebooker?
I am a Facebooker, yeah. And I have to be careful, because I'm an oversharer by nature. So I have a major problem with Facebook.
More detail. What does that mean? More detail.
Every few weeks there's a story, isn't there, of some boss sacking somebody or finding out something somebody has done via the medium of Facebook. So you're right. I mean, you do have to be careful what goes on there, don't you?
I think that's a bit of an unfair use of it, actually. But actually, what that really does is highlight the problems with Facebook's positioning in our lives. We don't really know, as Andrew says, where the boundaries start and stop with Facebook. You know, some of us use it professionally. I've used it to promote a book, for example. So that's quite different to the way that I used it. I use it in a sort of personal capacity to speak with my friends and share information with them. But I've been interested in myself. My relationship with Facebook has changed over the years because I've become much more guarded as I've realised it's actually not the place to post, you know, personal declarations of, you know, negative feelings and all the rest of it. But I think what is interesting about it is that the Facebook community itself realises that it can have multiple uses. And that's very much the future of social media now, you know. It's not just a place to kind of talk to your friends online. It's a place to self-promote. It's a place to build an online community to, you know, get people involved in certain projects. It's a place to fundraise. And I think that element of it is really exciting, really interesting. And that's also why I don't believe that Facebook is dead yet by any stretch of the imagination.
I still think it's quite nice, isn't it, to find what you've classmates are from years ago, what they're up to, what they're doing, and how ugly they are.
Yeah, but I meet up with mine. I think that's much better.
I agree.
Because if
yeah.
you just talk to each other on Facebook, you don't actually talk to each other directly. And I worry that Facebook is marking the death of conversation in the way I worry that some of the social media means the death of reading books.
I have to completely agree with Andrew. Like, I mean, before the internet, I read books. I mean, I'm a writer that doesn't read enough. That's one of my biggest problems.
Nikki, you're a disgrace, and we shall never have you on this programme again.
Well, you know, I'm outing myself. There we go. I've overshared again.
We've got two stories to squeeze in. Come on, I'm going to do this. We're going to do this on time. Okay. You're listening to Chart the Week. Andrew Pearce and Nikki Hodgson are here. Time for the story we've put at number two. Michael Gove's been teaching us the three R's: reading, writing, and riling lefties.
At number two.
Everybody needs an education.
In a speech this morning, Michael Gove called for longer days, more discipline, and students taking the equivalent of the Common Entrance exam.
We know that England's private schools are regularly ranked as the best independent schools in the world. So why shouldn't our state schools be regularly ranked as the best state schools in the world? Instead of reinforcing the Berlin Wall between state and private, we should break it down.
And that would be great if we could have classes of maybe a dozen or 20, but of course our class sizes are 30, and some of them are actually growing under Mr. Gove's time as Secretary of State.
Mr. Gove! Individual. You need to write out 1,000 times. I will behave myself at Prime Minister's question.
Feisty. This week, the Education Secretary, Michael Gove, said he wanted English state schools to be the best in the world and to see the dismantling of the Berlin Wall between state and private education. I'm going to give you both 30 seconds on Michael Gove. Nikki, you're on.
OK, I was privately educated. My brother was state educated. We had a very interesting educational experiment in my household. We ended up with exactly the same academic results and have both gone on to sort of similar level careers. What really made the difference was the support we got at home. And that includes all the extracurricular stuff, which is what Gove is praising now.
And I think Gove is one of the genuine radicals in the cabinet. I think if he's ruffling the feathers of the lefties, Dan, he's probably doing a pretty good job because they have been opposed to some of these major changes in education for many years. And let's face it, who started upsetting them first? That man, Tony Blair.
OK, and the final story, number one this week, it's all about the floods. Prince Charles visited the submerged Somerset Levels this week. It seems, Andrew, that we spend most of this time trying to find somebody to blame about this story. Do we blame the government? Do we blame the Environment Agency? Or do we just need a big cuddle and remember that the water will eventually go down?
Everybody's blaming everybody else, and it was pathetic to hear the Prime Minister and Ed Miliband trading insults about who'd spent the most money on flood defences. What I thought was a bit interesting was to see the Prince of Wales turning up, doing a great job down there, cheering people up no end, and unlike Owen Paterson, the Secretary of State, he at least wore some Wellingtons. Mr. Paterson turned up in shiny black brogues. Not good.
Brogues not good for floods. Nikki?
Yeah, I was talking about this story on TV at Christmas. I went away to America, came back, it's still happening. The Environment Agency really needed to get the warnings out to the people in their homes quicker. That's the kind of overriding feeling I have. And I think that's the stuff that needs to be focused on now. How do you help people that are actually on the brink of being flooded? That stuff still hasn't been solved.
That's it for today's podcast of The Daily Bacon. I'm Dan Walker, sitting in for Mr. Bacon himself. And I shall return with another show for you on Monday. So hopefully we'll see you.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.